Yes, it's Professor Buzzkill here with a special holiday episode about the classic Hollywood film, It's a Wonderful Life. Imagine being tortured by wartime memories. Explosions, death, mutilated bodies, some of them friends of yours. All the screaming. Now, imagine them coming from a very confined and dangerous place. I've always thought that being in a warplane or a submarine would add the extra stress of being trapped and not being able to contemplate running away from the situation. If you leave a submarine, you'll drown. If you leap out of an airplane without first having put on a parachute, you'll fall to your death. You're trapped. Of course, even the most vivid and active imagination can't come close to the horrifying realities of war and having to live with those images forever. And if I'm right about the added submarine and airplane stress, it's entirely possible that if you survive a war with those experiences, the memories could affect almost everything you do for the rest of your life. That's one of the things that war-induced post-traumatic stress disorder can do to people. Not all veterans of battle get PTSD. It can vary in intensity, and in the most extreme cases, it can ruin lives and lead to suicide. Well, Professor, I can hear you saying, this is a grim introduction to a podcast episode about what is widely regarded as one of the most uplifting, heartwarming, and life-affirming Hollywood films of all time. It's a Wonderful Life, starring Jimmy Stewart, Donna Reed, and a host of other character actors. Yes, I suppose it is a grim introduction to a podcast episode about It's a Wonderful Life, but you'll soon see what I mean. This 1946 Frank Capra film is a holiday classic, played every year at this time in the United States and Canada and in some other countries. It's the story of a man whose dreams never came true, who thinks his life has been worthless and who contemplates suicide. He's then shown by his guardian angel what life in his town and among his friends and family would have been like if he had not lived. This helps him realize that individuals have value and that it's a great gift to be shown just how much one's life can affect the lives of other people. It's a Wonderful Life is routinely listed among the greatest films of all time. It makes almost every film organization's top 100 list and is often in the top 10. The Library of Congress has listed it among the, quote, culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant works of art in American history, thereby giving it special preservation status. The American Film Institute ranks it number one in the category Most Inspirational American Films. And more about its critical legacy later. The basic plot is well known. George Bailey is a very personable young man with big dreams of international travel and an interesting career, quote, building things, planning modern cities, and all that stuff, end quote, as he says early in the film. Circumstances that seem to be largely beyond his control conspire, however, to keep him in his small hometown of Bedford Falls, New York, and keep him working in the small family business that bores him. His opportunities to go away to college, to travel, to see the world, get sidetracked by relatively random events that thwart those opportunities just on the brink of him being able to take advantage of them. All the while, his friends, and perhaps most gallingly, his younger brother, go off and do other things, leaving George to stew in Bedford Falls. Now, George seems to handle all these frustrations relatively maturely with a reasonable amount of understanding and calmness. In the background, though, we know that his relatively pleasant life has also prevented him from fulfilling his aspirations. In essence, George is trapped like a pilot in a wounded plane. His nemesis in the movie, the town banker, mean old Mr. Potter, tells him exactly that. And here's the clip.
But George Bailey is not the common, ordinary yokel. He is an intelligent, smart, ambitious young man who hates his job, who hates the building and loan almost as much as I do. A young man who's been dying to get out on his own ever since he was born. A young man, the smartest one in the crowd, mind you. A young man who has to sit by and watch his friends go places because he's trapped. Yes, sir, trapped into frittering his life away, playing nursemaid to a lot of garlic eaters.
George's troubles reach their peak when a serious business crisis threatens to ruin even the little amount of dignity and self-worth he's built up over the years. In the space of more or less one day, George goes from being a relatively content man, more or less resigned to the fact that while never being able to go adventuring and living the life of his youthful dreams, his life has been more or less as good as one can hope. He goes from that to becoming convinced that his life has been worthless and that he's actually worth more dead than alive because of his life insurance policy. As he explains to Clarence, the guardian angel who's sent from heaven to stop George from killing himself, "I guess it would have been better if I'd never been born." And here's the original line delivered by Jimmy Stewart.
"I suppose it'd been better if I'd never been born at all."
"What'd you say?"
"I said I wish I'd never been born."
Clarence the angel is shocked, but then he sees an opportunity, an angelic teaching moment in the parlance of our times.
"Wait a minute. Wait a minute. That's an idea. What do you think? Yeah, that'll do it. All right. You've got your wish. You've never been born."
Clarence arranges it with the heavenly higher-ups to give George a glimpse of what life and his hometown of Bedford Falls would have been like if he had never been born. The town has become Pottersville, named after the greedy banker and major landlord, Mr. Potter. Clarence then leads George through the town to show him how Bedford Falls / Potterville had developed and what had happened to his friends and his family in a world where he had never existed. As you might expect from a Hollywood script, things weren't so good in the George Bailey free world. Rather than the sleepy and friendly Bedford Falls where he had grown up, Pottersville is a relatively raucous and slightly seedy place, and no one knows who he is. Of course, the woman who would have been his mother doesn't recognize him, and neither does the woman who would have been his wife. Eventually, the shock of it all leads George to realize that his life did have value and that he actually does want to have been born. He begs Clarence to let him live again.
"Clarence! Clarence! Help me, Clarence! Get me back! Get me back! I don't care what happens to me! Get me back to my wife and kids! Help me, Clarence, please! Please! I want to live again! I want to live again! I want to live again! Please, God! Let me live again."
His wish is granted, and George returns to his house with his friends and family there, all of them having worked together to help solve the business problem that nearly drove him to suicide. And, it's implied, all things in George's wonderful life remain happy ever after. Anyone who's seen the film recognizes and appreciates the wide range of emotion that Jimmy Stewart had to command in order to be able to play a character who goes through a lifetime of frustration, peaks of happiness, canyons of despair, and perhaps most difficult of all, he does it in a wonderfully convincing way. Even the hard-hearted cynic like yours truly sees the art and the talent and the skill in what Stewart was able to do. But was it all just art, talent, and skill? Now here's where we get to one of the big myths about It's a Wonderful Life, and where I explain why I started this episode talking about war trauma and PTSD. A Facebook and social media post flies around the internet at this time of year about Jimmy Stewart and his experiences as a World War II aviator and bomber pilot. We've put a link to this Facebook post in the blog post for this episode on ProfessorBuzzKill.com. The Facebook page where that post appears more or less tells the stories of American service members who have done extraordinary things during wartime. Perhaps the most popular post on that page is the one about Jimmy Stewart's World War II service and how it might have affected his acting in It's a Wonderful Life. The post tells the basic and very interesting story about Stewart joining the Army in 1941, of him pushing against the Army's attempts to have him make training films and raise money by selling war bonds, and of having Stewart more or less insist that he be given combat assignments. All this is true. The American military routinely used actors and celebrities in promotional and training roles, partly because they were very good at these tasks, and partly because, well, frankly, having a well-known person die in combat might have a dampening effect on wartime morale. And it's also true that Jimmy Stewart worked very hard to get himself posted to a combat unit. Stewart had been an accomplished licensed pilot before the war and had logged enough hours to make him an obvious choice to be a flight instructor for new pilots. but he pestered his superiors to let him transfer to the European theater to fly bombing missions as the Allies began heavy bombing of Germany in 1943-1944. The Army Air Corps finally relented, and he was sent to England to command B-24 Liberator bomber squadrons in their devastating missions over Germany. By all reliable accounts, Stuart was an excellent pilot, highly effective commander, and was superb at squadron organization and management. But the Facebook post then goes on to say, and this is a long quote, "But his wartime service came at a high personal price. In the final months of World War II, he was grounded for being flak happy, today called post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. When he returned to the U.S. in August 1945, Stuart was a changed man. He'd lost so much weight that he looked sickly. He rarely slept, and when he did, he had nightmares of planes exploding and men falling through the air screaming. In one mission alone, his unit had lost 13 planes and 130 men, most of whom he knew personally. He was depressed, couldn't focus, and refused to talk to anyone about his wartime experiences. His acting career was all but over. As one of Stuart's biographers put it, every decision he made during the war was going to preserve life or cost lives. He took back to Hollywood all the stress that he had built up. In 1946, he got his break. He took the role of George Bailey, the suicidal father in It's a Wonderful Life. The rest is history. Actors and crew on the set realized that in many of the disturbing scenes of George Bailey unraveling in front of his family, Stuart wasn't acting. His PTSD was being captured on film for potentially millions to see. But despite Stuart's inner turmoil, making the movie was therapeutic for the combat veteran. He would go on to become one of the most accomplished and loved actors in American history. As many of us watch the classic Christmas film, It's a Wonderful Life, it's also a fitting time to remember the sacrifices of Jimmy Stuart and all the men who gave up so much to serve their country during wartime. We will always remember you." End quotation. Now, we can all agree with the final sentiment, that is, we should always remember and honor the sacrifice that military veterans made during World War II. But we should also be careful not to jump to conclusions or make unproven statements about the specifics of someone's service and how it affected their later life. To do so is not only historically dicey, but it risks overlooking and undervaluing the actual trauma that other service people suffered and still suffer. You can tell by the trajectory of what I'm saying here that I'm about to tell you that the story of Jimmy Stuart having PTSD that was induced by war trauma is untrue. But in doing so, I want to stress the difficulties in actually determining such things. Yes, undoubtedly, Jimmy Stuart must have seen horrific stuff during his bombing missions, even if at a distance. And it is certain that combat flying, especially when you're in a relatively slow airplane like a bomber, which is kind of an easy target for anti-aircraft fire, is incredibly stressful and wearing on a pilot's nerves and broader psychology. So I don't want to discount any of that. But essentially, like so many social media history stories, there's no good evidence that Jimmy Stuart suffered from battle fatigue, from shell shock, or that he became flak happy because of his bombing runs over Germany, apart from normal war weariness. There is also no good evidence that he suffered PTSD after the war, or that the effects of PTSD came out during the filming of some of the more distressing and emotional scenes in It's a Wonderful Life. And there is absolutely no evidence that the, quote, actors and crew, as the Facebook post has it, on the production set of It's a Wonderful Life, and again, I'm quoting here, realized, end quote, that Stuart's acting in the more disturbing scenes came from war trauma. Again, this is not to say that it definitely didn't happen. Remember, when analyzing history, it's almost impossible to prove a negative. But I am saying there's no good evidence that it ever did happen. There are no Army Air Corps medical records to suggest that Jimmy Stuart suffered from these things or that he was grounded because of them. And there's plenty of good evidence to show that Jimmy Stuart's very effective and convincing performance in It's a Wonderful Life came from his talent, from his acting experience, and from Frank Capra's direction. It's easy to dismiss the PTSD acting story by an examination of Stewart's performances in his early career. From his first supporting roles in various theater productions in the early 1930s, critics quickly noticed his abilities to play a variety of parts, from the upsetting to the comical. He broke into motion pictures in 1934, first as an uncredited extra, and then working in various supporting roles throughout the mid-1930s. Critics at the time usually ignored actors in smaller parts, but several writers, who'd also seen him perform in plays, wrote that their initial assessments of him as an excellent theater actor were borne out in his first films. In fact, the New York Herald Tribune complained that he was being underused as a side character in his first big film, 1935's The Murder Man. Better roles eventually followed, and by the late 1930s, Stewart was a leading man, usually playing average people whose extraordinary talents and gifts and determination are revealed through the various plot devices and challenges in any good movie plot. Even a cursory glance at his filmography and the critical reception of his work in the 1930s shows a very talented young actor working his way up the Hollywood ladder and sharpening his skills with each new picture. By the time he appeared in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington in 1939, it was very clear that Stewart was a major star. And if you haven't seen Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, by the way, I recommend it very highly. It's a Capra film, like It's a Wonderful Life. Stewart's part as Jefferson Smith, an everyman sent to Washington whose backbone prevents him from being eaten up by the various political machines and graft going on there, is excellent. The emotional range required to play Mr. Smith was handled admirably by Jimmy Stewart, even if a lot of the plot was corny. And it was exactly the type of emotional range that Stewart had to draw upon for It's a Wonderful Life, filmed 7 years later. In between those two movies, Stewart appeared in 8 major Hollywood films, ranging from gritty westerns to feel-good stories to outright comedies and farces. And of course, he had grown older, and undoubtedly, his wartime experiences helped shape his overall character and work. So how did the story about wartime PTSD appear? Well, before I go any further, I want to acknowledge that the heavy lifting for this episode was done by other historians and investigative journalists. Their work and links to it are provided in the blog post for this episode. But Dan McGuill, an international journalist and noted fact-checker, wrote an excellent summary of this myth in his Snopes article. He concludes that the wartime PTSD is shown in Jimmy Stewart's acting story is, quote, unproven. As I said earlier, though, I feel more strongly about this story, and that's why I say not only is it unproven, there's no good evidence for it. The original Facebook post seems to have been based on the book Mission, Jimmy Stewart and the Fight for Europe by Robert Matson. In that book, Matson argues that Stewart became flak happy during the later stages of the war and had to be grounded by the Army Air Corps to prevent him from having some sort of mental breakdown during a mission. While Matson had done research about the combat conditions and experiences of American flyers over Europe during World War II, the evidence for Stewart suffering from PTSD comes mainly from one source, the interview that Matson conducted with a fellow American World War II flyer, Lieutenant Barry Shillitoe. According to Shillitoe, Stewart changed visibly in appearance, lost weight that a lanky man like him couldn't afford to lose, and that he, quote, went flak happy there for a while, end quote. But that's where the direct connection with Jimmy Stewart and suffering from war trauma ends. The stories about Stewart being plagued by nightmares, about exploding planes, body parts hitting his aircraft, and the sound of airmen screaming as they fell from the skies were based on the general and overall reports of nightmares and the trauma that happened to some American pilots. Undoubtedly, as I keep saying and implying, Jimmy Stewart suffered during his wartime experience. Given the types of missions he flew and the claustrophobic nature of flying a bomber, any pilot must have been seriously affected. But that is specifically why the Army Air Corps routinely stopped pilots from flying after a specific number of missions. After reaching a certain number of missions over enemy territory, Stewart was rotated out of combat assignments and given a promotion. He moved to the position of operations officer, planning and supervising missions, including deciding which flyers needed rest and when they should take it. More reliable work done by military historian Star Smith, who had served with Stewart, and by Michael Mann, the film historian, shows that this was more or less standard procedure, and that Stewart's range of abilities, which included on-the-ground organization and leadership, brought about his promotion, not fear of him losing it behind the controls. And at any rate, Stewart wouldn't have had much of a choice. These types of assignment rotations and promotions were required after a certain number of missions had been flown. He couldn't have lobbied against it because it was actually an Army Air Corps procedure and regulation, unlike the informal practice of using celebrities mainly for PR work. Again, according to Smith, the military historian who served with Stewart during World War II, quote, "When the appointment was announced, nothing was said about flying too many missions. The official word was that the 453rd needed an operations officer, and Major Stewart had been promoted to the job," end quote. Further, there is no direct evidence of Stewart being flak happy or having nightmares either during his war years or afterwards about aviators falling from the sky. Again, both of these things were technically possible, and Stewart could have done a good job of hiding them for the rest of his life. It's also very unlikely that war trauma would have gone unnoticed by Stewart's commanders. The diagnosis of PTSD didn't exist in the 1940s, but doctors and medical researchers had been studying war-induced psychological trauma for decades. In the 19th century, it was called battle fatigue. And then with the enormous increase in the mechanization of war and the power of explosives, it became known as shell shock, mostly during World War I. And the study of it only improved during World War II. PTSD is a much newer term. Diagnostic methods have gotten much better in the last half century, and so has treatment, but the knowledge of this kind of trauma had been with us for a long time. It's not as if this trauma was unknown during World War II. Still, the Jimmy Stewart World War II PTSD to It's a Wonderful Life story is a very hardy one. It's impossible to do an exhaustive study across all social media, but Buzzkill Institute researchers tell me that close to 70,000 Facebook users have read the story and clicked like. And the number of shares is impossible to determine. It's also very common to see it on Twitter and Instagram, especially this time of year. Now, unless and until there's some reasonably hard evidence for it, this story remains just that, a story. Like so many stories we've analyzed on this show over the years, its truth, and I'm putting truth in quotation marks here, relies on a number of fallacies. The first is, as I mentioned before, reasoning from the very general to the highly specific, that bomber pilots and crews sometimes witnessed horrific scenes of battle, and that therefore Jimmy Stewart must have seen such things as, quote, bodies falling through the air, end quote, and heard, quote, screams of falling airmen, end quote, even though there's no good evidence that he did. The story takes that as a given. And from there, it makes the assumption that Stewart's war trauma came through in his post-war acting, especially in the scenes of suicidal desperation in It's a Wonderful Life. Once you believe that there's enough evidence for the trauma in the first place, then everything else that follows in the story just seems to make sense. In this chain of reasoning, it's not surprising at all. In fact, it seems inevitable that Jimmy Stewart would draw on his emotional experience of being flak happy to make George Bailey's desperation seem more believable. As I've said, however, there's lots of good evidence that the range of emotion shown in Stewart's work on It's a Wonderful Life was built on 2 decades of increasingly sophisticated practice of his craft. Again, you only have to look at the climactic scenes in 1939's Mr. Smith Goes to Washington to see exactly the same display of acting skills and nearly the exact same emotions that would show up in It's a Wonderful Life. Certainly, being in the war affected Stewart like it did everyone else, and it probably contributed to the maturity and subtlety displayed in the second half of his career. Despite the fact that all this makes me sound like an uber buzzkill, bordering on being a misanthrope, I do so because I think it's crucial to read the things you come across on social media and in emails with a skeptical eye. If the story sounds too good to be true, or if it has all the right answers pat down, it's probably weak on the evidence side, and the real, full story is certainly more complicated. If you can believe this story about Jimmy Stewart, war trauma, and It's a Wonderful Life, given how thinly sourced it is, No wonder people believe crazy political stories that fly across social media. Okay, now that I've ruined a part of your holiday warmth regarding that aspect of It's a Wonderful Life mythology, let me quickly address some of the minor myths and offer some other observations about the film. Despite being one of the most popular, highest-ranked, and best-loved movies of all time, It's a Wonderful Life was not an immediate hit when it was released on December 20th, 1946, competing with The Best Years of Our Lives, another brilliant, absolutely brilliant film. And with the Christmas feel-good movie, Miracle on 34th Street, It's a Wonderful Life didn't seem to find a place or a niche with the public or with the critics. You'll often hear that the film was panned by the critics. It was another dose of Capricorn, a play on Capra, the director's name, and his tendency to make the same sorts of heartwarming, corny films about individuals overcoming hardship for the good of their fellow citizens over and over again. But that's only partly true. The film reviewers who didn't like it concentrated on what they saw as shallowness in the plot and characters. For instance, Bosley Crowther wrote in the New York Times on December 23rd, 1946, which is 3 days after the film's release, and I quote, "Mr. Capra's nice people are charming, his small town is a quite beguiling place, and his pattern for solving problems is most optimistic and facile. But somehow, they all resemble theatrical attitudes rather than average realities." End quote. And there were many similar criticisms leveled at the film, but it's a myth that this was the universal reception. Time magazine loved it. It's a Wonderful Life is a pretty wonderful movie. It has only one formidable rival, Goldwyn's The Best Years of Our Lives, as Hollywood's best picture of the year. Director Capra's inventiveness, humor, and affection for human beings keep it glowing with life and excitement. Incidentally, published on the same day as the critical New York Times review I just read, It's a Wonderful Life won only one Academy Award, a special one for the technical achievement of creating artificial snow in a new and improved way. I know, yawn, yawn. And then for the most part, the film just went into the Hollywood back catalog with so many others. It was revived, however, in a very interesting way during the holiday season of 1976. Yes, 1976. Over the years, the television syndication rights to the film had passed from Liberty Films, its original owner, to Paramount, to National Telefilm Associates. But in 1974, the correct filing forms for continuing the copyright on the film got screwed up and the copyright wasn't renewed. So television stations were able to play it at a considerable savings in copyright fees, and it was aired frequently in the second half of the 1970s. It was watched by millions and became more popular than it ever had been. And oh, by the way, the copyright story has become a legend in itself, but there's a teeny tiny mini myth associated with it. The film and its images slipped out of copyright and entered the public domain, but the copyright on the original story, called The Greatest Gift by author Philip Van Doren Stern, upon which the film had been based, remained. So it's a myth that the reason It's a Wonderful Life became so widely seen was that television stations could play it, quote, for free. In fact, they still had to pay, admittedly, less for the copyright fees for the original story. So the slipped into the public domain thing was not the real reason why it was shown so often. It became a much cheaper film, the show, starting in 1976, but it wasn't technically free, but its popularity was such after 1976 that It's a Wonderful Life became a Hollywood classic starting in the late 1970s because, again, after being shown at a discounted rate, if you will, so often, people started to watch it a lot and value it for its own sake, and it became commonplace for TV stations to air it. By the early 1980s, it had become so popular during the holiday season that no station management in its right mind would quibble over the pittance they had to pay for the original story copyright. From then, it took off. It's been colorized a couple of times and has been produced on stage across the country, certainly since the 1990s and early 2000s. A couple of other myths and urban legends about It's a Wonderful Life remain, however. It's not true, for instance, that the popular characters Bert and Ernie on the children's program Sesame Street were named after two important characters in the film, Bert the cop and Ernie the cab driver. This is a coincidence, even though Sesame Street has had fun slipping in references to the film during some of Bert and Ernie's sketches over the years. And even though Seneca Falls in upstate New York has held an It's a Wonderful Life festival every December for years, and the town has claimed that it was the inspiration for Bedford Falls, the setting of the movie, there's no evidence for that either. In fact, the author of the original story, The Greatest Gift, said in 1946, long before the film became a classic, that the story and film were set in Westchester County, just north of New York City. There's a town called Bedford in Westchester County, but Van Dornstern said, quote, "The town I had in mind was Califon, New Jersey, near to where he grew up. These places are 250 miles from Seneca Falls." A larger myth, and perhaps a longer standing myth, is that the film has been universally admired for its positive and life-affirming message over the decades. In 1946-47, as I said earlier, those who didn't like the film called it shallow and said that the emotions on the display were merely cardboard cutouts of genuine emotion. In more recent decades, It's a Wonderful Life has been characterized as dark and claustrophobic, with a depressing plot about how the vagaries and sort of bad luck chaos involved in life can grind an individual down and drive him to near suicide. A critic for the New York Times wrote in 2008 that It's a Wonderful Life was far more complex than a simple feel-good tale about realizing your own value. It was also, quote, "a terrifying, asphyxiating story about growing up and relinquishing your dreams, of being trapped," there's that word again, "of compromising, of watching others move ahead and away, of becoming so filled with rage that you verbally abuse your children, their teacher, and your oppressively perfect wife." Other critics have called it, quote, "the most terrifying Hollywood film ever made," end quote, and, quote, "one of the most profoundly pessimistic tales of human existence ever to achieve a lasting popularity," end quote. And again, the citations for all these things are on the blog post. Now, you know what a glory hound I am. I want to take some credit for this late 20th century, early 21st century take on the film. I remember very clearly that it hit me one day out of the blue in the early 1990s. Wait a minute. Sure, George Bailey's short-term business and financial problems are solved in the film's climax, but he's more or less still back where he started, trapped in Bedford Falls, with daily reminders of his abandoned dreams all around him. Unfortunately, I wasn't smart enough to record these revelations in print back then in order to prove that they originated with me. So I just started myth-busting, heart-unwarming podcast instead. Now, I don't know for sure, and my parents aren't telling, and the family archives and records are silent about this, but if my memory is correct, we've been watching It's a Wonderful Life in the family buzzkill for a very, very long time, maybe even before the increase in airing after 1976. My mother more or less insisted that we watch it when we were young, and then she'd tell us what a good story it was and that the story had a good moral. But I can't resist saying this. There's another important thing about It's a Wonderful Life that fits in well with the aims of this podcast. And that's asking people to recognize that it's not just the stars of history who make it such a rich and important subject of study. It's not just Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed. We spend an awful lot of time on this show talking about how people overlook and undervalue the vast numbers of lesser-known historical figures who deserve our attention. You know what I keep complaining about. Winston Churchill gets painted as the sole victor in the Battle of Britain. Franklin Roosevelt ended the Depression single-handedly. John F. Kennedy put a man on the moon practically all by himself. And although I sound like a cranky old Mr. Potter every time I go on about this, the stars are given far too much credit. There are countless people who are overlooked who shouldn't be. And so I'd like to wrap things up by asking you to watch the fantastic performances by all the other actors in the film. Note especially how well they accomplish the multiple transformations that they must undertake during the plot. First of all, there's a simple passage of time during the story, from George getting ready to go to college in the early 1920s to the stock market crash of 1929 to the end of World War II. But that's a common demand placed on actors. Not so common is to be asked to play the same character in completely different versions of reality, Bedford Falls at one point and Potterville at another. For instance, Nick the bartender, played by Sheldon Leonard, works in a family restaurant in the real Bedford Falls, but slings booze and cracks wise in a rough joint in Pottersville. The marvelous H.B. Warner, a star from the silent film era, plays the kindly town pharmacist in Bedford Falls, but a drunken ex-con in Pottersville. Ward Bond played Bert the Cop in both towns, but shaded his portrayal wonderfully to fit the character of the two different places, and there are lots of others. I want especially to mention Beulah Bondi, who plays Mrs. Bailey, George's mother. The way she handles the transformation from the kindly family matriarch at Bedford Falls to the bitter old owner of a boarding house in Pottersville is masterful. Beulah Bondi appears only briefly in three or four scenes in the film, but each time the acting is perfect. In fact, she was one of the most successful and prolific character actors in Hollywood. Her career started with the 1931 film Street Scene and ended with an Emmy Award-winning performance in the popular Waltons series on television in 1976. And get this, she played Jimmy Stewart's mother in four different films, between Of Human Hearts in 1938 to It's a Wonderful Life in 1946, including the Capra classic mentioned earlier, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington of 1939. It is essentially Beulah Bondi as Mrs. Bailey in Bedford Falls, who first tells George in his 20s that he's living a wonderful life and should open his eyes to what's in front of him. Pushing him off to go visit Mary Hatch, played by Donna Reed, was her way of trying to make him see what was right there waiting for him.
Did you know that Mary Hatch is back from school?
Mm-hmm.
Came back 3 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
Nice girl, Mary.
Mm-hmm.
Kind that'll help you find the answers, George.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, stop that grunting.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me one good reason why you shouldn't call on Mary?
Sure, Sam Wainwright.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Sam's crazy about Mary.
Oh, she's not crazy about him.
Well, how do you know? Now, would she discuss it with him?
No.
Well, then how do you know?
Well, I've got eyes, haven't I? She lights up like a firefly whenever you're around.
Oh.
Besides, Sam Wainwright's away in New York, and you're here in Bedford Falls.
And all's fair in love and war.
Oh, I don't know about war.
Mother mine, I can see right through you, right to your back collarbutton. Trying to get rid of me,
huh? Mm-hmm.
Well, here's your hat. What's your hurry? All right, mother old building and lone pal. I think I'll go out and find a girl and do a little passionate necking. Now, if you'll just point me in the right direction. This direction.
And now, here she is in Pottersville as a wary and suspicious boarding house owner, confronted by a panicked George telling her that he's her son.
Well?
Mother.
Mother? What do you want?
Mother, this is George. I thought sure you'd remember me.
George who? If you're looking for a room, there's no vacancy.
Mother, listen. Please help me. Something terrible's happened to me. I don't know what it is. Something's happened to everybody. Please let me come in and keep me here until I get over it.
Get over what? I don't take in strangers unless they're sent here by somebody I know.
Well, I know everybody you know. What, your brother-in-law, Uncle Billy.
You know him?
Well, sure I do.
When'd you see him last?
Today, over at his house.
It's a lie. He's been in the insane asylum ever since he lost his business. And if you ask me, that's where you belong.
You'll see her mastery of the range of emotions more clearly when you watch the movie again this year. By the end of It's a Wonderful Life, George realizes that dreams aren't necessarily what makes a good and happy life. He learns that too much time spent with your eyes looking over the horizon and wondering what's over the next hill risks keeping you from appreciating what's right in front of you. And what's right in front of you may indeed be the fulfillment of your dreams. You just didn't realize it. That's what my mother told us at the end of the film each Christmas. And so it's with a shout out to my mother, the Duchess of Buzzkill, that I say, okay, old Buzzkill dynasty mother of mine, I'm off to concentrate on what's right in front of me. The dishes. I have to do the dishes. They're there because I have buzzlings to take care of in what I now realize is my wonderful life. And I'll say to you Buzzkillers out there that I'll talk to you next week. But right now, I'll let you join the party of the Bailey extended family and friends already in progress.
Good idea, Ernie. A toast. To my big brother, George, the richest man in town.
Christmas present from a very dear friend of mine.
Look, Daddy, teacher says every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
That's right. That's right.
Attaboy, Clarence.